I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE as we continue to cover the triumph of Trump as world leaders from the G20 gather today in Brazil. The impact of the tragedy of 4 years of genocide Joe Holocaust Harris will be clear to non-NATO members as the annihilation of Gaza continues and UK-US-EU arms rain down not only on Palestine but on Lebanon, Yemen and Iraq. Western European economies face disaster after the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine. Internally, a class-divided USA arguably lies in ruins. Should we even really be surprised that those known for progressive views on some issues like Joe Rogan, RFK Jr., Dennis Kucinich, abandoned the Democrats? Third wave, feminist Professor Naomi Wolf abandoned them, and she advised both Bill Clinton and Al Gore presidential campaigns, the best-selling author of The Beauty Myth, The End of America, and most recently the Pfizer Papers, Pfizer's Crimes Against Humanity, joins me now from New York. Naomi, thanks so much for coming on the show. Happy birthday for last week. You know, it was one of America's greatest historians, Gore Vidal, who said any president who tackled the U.S. healthcare pharma complex, presumably also big agriculture, would be destroyed by those powerful interests. Why do you believe, maybe you don't believe, RFK Jr., let alone Trump, will actually survive ahead of the 20th of January next year?
Whoa. Well, first, I wasn't familiar with that quote. That's interesting. I'll have to check that.
I think it was Gore Vidal about the healthcare reforms that Clinton was going to make, and he said he expected any president to be found having sex with children in a cemetery, basically, because the whole media, everyone would be against any president because of the powerful interests of Big Pharma that you've written about, actually.
I'll have to look. Gore Vidal was, a sensation, like he liked a sensational quote. So I that's one of those things I definitely need to check for myself. But did you just ask me why I believe the president and RFK Jr. will survive till January 20th?
Well, obviously there have been assassination attempts, and you can see already the reaction of liberal media, as it were. Will they actually survive? I mean, how dangerous is it now for them?
Do you mean physically survive? You're literally asking me.
I think I probably do, actually. I mean, how powerful are Big Pharma and Big Agriculture? What have they tried to do to you for the Pfizer papers?
Honestly, respectfully, I think it's quite inappropriate for journalists to speculate about the murder of a president-elect or an ally or colleague of his in advance of a peaceful transfer of power. I think it's, I believe in free speech.
I'm not speculating and trying to encourage it. I'm saying to illustrate how powerful these interests are and what the stakes are in allowing people to democratically transfer power and to actually do the kinds of changes that have been spoken about of Big Pharma, for instance.
I mean, I think that it becomes more dangerous when the press raises violent possibilities. I just really strongly encourage you to, rephrase that, because I don't really want to be, part of a conversation.
No, of course not. But I mean, what threats, for instance, let's just go back to your book.
Like, how do you know any of us will survive?
I mean,
how do you know any elected official will survive? How do you know any head of state will survive? These are quite threatening things to speculate.
Well, how high are the stakes? I mean, I've heard you say that even the election means they will have to attenuate any reaction to how they tackle both Big Agriculture and Big Pharma at the same time, and maybe they should do this one more slowly than the other. Such are the powerful interests.
That was
in the attack.
For messaging purpose. That was advice I gave for success, and I gave it in public for successful messaging purposes. That if you take on too much at once, and I gave similar advice, which I can't disclose, do it in an NDA. But every campaign I've ever advised, I recommended that they take things on thematically. Take do a week or 2 weeks on agriculture, do a week or 2 weeks on pharma, do a week or 2 weeks on literacy and reforming, you know, the school system, do a week or 2 weeks on making the IRS leaner and more accountable. It's just about good messaging, because if you tackle everything at once and make a lot of scattershot, very exciting announcements, then we have a situation in which you and I talking about what's going on are not presented with an obvious theme that we have to which we have to respond. We're presented with a great deal of information, which makes it harder for journalists to cover any one specific theme. So that was my advice about that. It wasn't about be careful, you know, physically. I mean, every president and every cabinet member who takes on powerful interests knows that powerful interests will try to protect their, you know, resources. But I really want to move this conversation to a conversation about the peaceful transfer of power and getting things done in policy terms rather than life or death terms. I think it's so inappropriate to raise that possibility.
So the Pfizer papers, for instance, what will we hear as to how they, I mean, I don't know whether RFK Jr. has read your book, whether they will use the information in that to get some sort of closure. Maybe it's too early to talk about closure for the years of lies as regards the pandemic.
I really don't know. My dad was a writer, and he said that, you know, your responsibility or your kind of a task with every nonfiction book, well, fiction too, for that matter, but I only write nonfiction, ends with the final word, and it's up to the readers to, you know, make what they will of any book you write. So this is a really important book. We've put it out, we've published it, which is itself a miracle given the wall of censorship around us, or that tried to silence this book. Three different governments tried to silence this book. There was just a judgment in Britain. Mark Stein, who gave me a platform to bring some of the harms in these reports before this book was published to a British audience and global audience through GB News, he's just been fined £50,000 or tasked with paying that amount for legal fees when he sought to defend his reputation and his career. And I went there also to support him in court against Ofcom, their media watchdog agency in Britain, suppressing the information, not saying it was not true, but saying that it was harmful to reveal the truth about it. So I hope, of course, you know, our volunteers, these 3,250 doctors and scientists who have who have mobilized under our leadership, mine and my colleague Amy Kelly's, to read through the 450,000 internal Pfizer documents released under court order. The FDA asked the court to keep them hidden for 75 years. The court said no. These volunteers have testified and brought these findings twice to the Australian Parliament. They brought them to the Brazilian Parliament, which reacted by taking mandates off the table for children with these injections because they're so dangerous and damaging. They brought them to a British parliamentarian. They brought them to senators sitting in our own Congress. So I certainly hope that, you know, this book and its findings, which documents the greatest crime against humanity in recorded history, will continue to be used. I think it's a factor in the big judgments you're seeing. I don't have a direct knowledge of that, but you know what's in the Pfizer papers is now public. It's in you know, medical libraries. It's in my local library in Brooklyn, this book. So you're seeing now, since the book came out, multi-million dollar judgments in favor of people who were coerced into getting this dangerous, knowingly dangerous injection, knowingly sterilizing, deadly in some cases injection. And you're also seeing multi-million dollar settlements for people who lost their jobs when they refused to comply. So, you know, obviously, I hope it continues to have a life in litigation, in justice for the victims. And it's a matter of public record. Beyond that, I really don't know what will happen.
Yeah, I mean, this show knows all about Ofcom. They have their latest reports out today. This is the British censorship agency. We're in Dubai, so we don't have to worry about that here. But I suppose when this interview perhaps goes on social media, we'll still have a slight worry in covering issues of the Pfizer papers because we'll put it up on Google's YouTube ahead of this election. Yeah, exactly. Well, you can tell me a bit about that. But ahead of the Trump inauguration, I mean, at least do we look forward to the end of that kind of censorship industrial complex? Matt Taibbi was on the show the other day talking about the Twitter files, working with the Elon Musk's data. I mean, what's going to happen to Zuckerberg, Sundar Pichai of Google? What do you expect? Not just related to your work, but to freedom of speech.
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I'm happy that you asked it. It's so ironic, right? I come from the left, as you mentioned in your introduction. I've been a lifelong Democrat, and then I walked away and finally endorsed President Trump, you know, in alliance with RFK Jr. In advance of the election, and encouraged liberals and independents to vote for them. And it's so ironic because the massive groundswell of response, including from the legacy media, my former employers, The Guardian, fears that the Trump era, Trump RFK era, will be a time of fascism. And of course, the suppression of free speech is part of the fascist toolkit. I've been writing about that since my book, The End of America, which came out in 2008. But paradoxically, the people who censored me and Matt Taibbi and Michael Schellenberger and, you know, Professor Jay Bhattacharya of Stanford, who was making very important points about how lockdowns were going to drive millions of children into starvation, which they did, Professor Martin Kulldorff of Harvard, any number of serious people, the people who censored us, who were fascistic about freedom of speech, were the people I voted for. The Biden administration censored me in June of 2021 when I correctly warned women around the world, but especially in the West, that women were reporting menstrual disorders, serious menstrual disorders upon receiving this mRNA injection. That was correct. And the Pfizer papers abundantly documents a 360-degree war on human reproduction, which has resulted now in 2024 in a 13 to 20% drop in live births, a million missing babies in Western Europe, horrific. And there are charts and Pfizer documents of horrific damage that Pfizer knew they were causing to the fertility and the menses of women, the poisoning of breast milk, the blocking of ovaries with lipid nanoparticles, the compromise of placentas leading to what is now a 40% rise in live births, an over 80% miscarriage rate in one section of the Pfizer documents, two babies dying in utero in the pregnancy and lactation report that Pfizer said was due to maternal exposure to the vaccine. This went to the White House, and then Dr. Walensky told the women of America there was no bad time to get an injection before your baby was born, during your pregnancy, or after your baby was born. So it's a massive crime, but the people who set up an office of disinformation and use the Stalinist coinage, which doesn't exist in a First Amendment society, misinformation, and put pressure, according to two attorneys general's lawsuits that, you know, have resulted in a disclosure of these emails by the White House. It was the White House pressuring tech companies to censor me, right? My accurate quote warning women about real damage, which really happened. That was the White House. That was the Biden White House. So I see that paradoxically, the Trump era is likely to be one of aggressive defenses for freedom of speech.
Okay, Naomi, we're just coming to a break now. I'll stop you there. More from the co-editor of the Pfizer papers, Pfizer's Crimes Against Humanity, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the co-editor of the Pfizer papers, Professor Naomi Wolf. So what exactly was the rationale behind publishers not refusing to publish it and so on? And, for instance, this English-British censorship complex saying we have to fine anyone who talks about revelations in it. What is behind all of these
Okay, so first aspects? Of all, no one refused to publish the Pfizer papers in the United States. We had a lovely offer from Skyhorse Publishing, which is a division of Simon & Schuster, and you can find the Pfizer papers in any local library. You can walk into Barnes & Noble. You can order it from Amazon. No one refused to publish it because it is completely accurate. The second thing is the judgment against Mark Stein and even the court case in which I appeared about the Ofcom's action against Mark Stein's show, the judge acknowledged that it wasn't stating that anything we said was inaccurate. It wasn't stating that anything I presented was not true. It was saying that even if it was true, it was harmful to disclose the truth because it could upset people. That was their legal reasoning, and you can go to my Substack Outspoken or get the judgment. It's a matter of public record, in the Royal Courts of Justice. So please don't mischaracterize. No one has said anything in this book is not true. There's been no resistance to publishing it in the United States. Around the world, we're getting inquiries from Germany and the Netherlands. The Netherlands has demanded that Bill Gates come to court to answer charges. You know, after I came with the findings of the Pfizer papers to the Netherlands, it's simply not accurate that there's been any statement that anything in this book is not correct. The censorship that we do get is from outlets like YouTube and certainly all of British media and certainly all of the legacy media, because they don't want to cover it. They don't want to cover it because they colluded in taking the money to misinform people and suppress warnings about the dangers of these injections. Pardon me. And that's a legal exposure for those news outlets. And
so eventually how can they be brought to justice under a Trump term? Because clearly the Biden-Harris administration colluded just as much as all these censorship high-tech companies as well. The whole of Western Europe, I suppose, is just you're just going to have to lay that to one side. They're not going to go the same way, arguably, as what's going to happen in the United States now. How does he go about...
I don't know what you mean by that. Excuse me, I don't know what you mean by that, because people who learn the truth about what's in the Pfizer documents all over Western Europe are very upset, and they are wanting their speech rights back, and they want their representation.
Yeah, there is no, I'm speaking to you from personal experience, there is no freedom of speech in Western Europe. Rumble is banned outright in France. Whole context to wars currently being fought are not able to be broadcast about in Britain. So that's why I'm ignoring Western Europe for now. How? Right. But at least the United States has a First Amendment, and clearly the platform that Trump ran on was against censorship. So how does he begin to bring these people to justice?
Well, I'm not in any advisory role with the Trump campaign. So
yet.
I'm not in a position to tell you, except as a citizen. But as a citizen, there are many ways to bring these people to justice all around the world, including in Western Europe and the Middle East and Israel and Australia and Africa. First of all, they violated international law because the Nuremberg Code calls for you can't do medical experiments on humans without their informed consent. It's completely illegal. And that's what Pfizer and Moderna and AstraZeneca, though we don't have Moderna's and AstraZeneca's papers yet, that's what these companies in league with governments around the world did. They violated international law by withholding informed consent from people and engaging in a massive medical experiment on them. There are other ways to bring them to justice. We have two lawsuits civilly. They're liable, right? Civilly, you can sue the FDA, you can sue the White House, and you can sue private corporations. That's the nature of many of the lawsuits that are underway right now. We've advised one team of criminal attorneys. They're going after, I believe, RICO crimes and trafficking. Arguably, it's trafficking the bodies of people who were forced to receive the injection. certainly there's fraud involved. You know, one of the criminal offenses that attorneys general in the U.S. have looked at is false advertising, which state by state is a criminal offense. Fraud is a criminal offense. They engaged in fraud by not telling people the truth about what was in the injections, by saying, oh, you might have, you know, pain at the injection site or a fever or fatigue. Well, Pfizer knew that, you know, tens of thousands of, you know, 42,000 plus serious adverse events in just 3 months, including 1,225 deaths. And it wasn't fatigue and chills and pain at the injection site. It's strokes and dementias and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and turbo cancers and blood clots and lung clots and leg clots and thrombotic thrombocytopenia and skin disorders of all kinds, kidney damage, liver damage, you know, the horrific menstrual and reproductive damage that I described. They knew all of this, you know, catastrophic neurological harms. And now we know the mechanism, right? The Pfizer papers shows people how they were injured. And it's very important because it begins to lay down the basis of a science for real healing, which people are not going to get from their doctors because the doctors took the money and complied. And the professional, you know, medical organizations took the money and complied. So those are multiple ways in the United States you can bring people to justice. In Britain, there have been some lawsuits by the vaccine injured. They've been successful. And something that that RFK Jr. has been talking about is ending advertising, direct consumer advertising of pharmaceutical companies to people. And that's going to change the landscape tremendously, because right now the, you know, television shows, news, don't cover damage from any pharmaceutical products because there's so much money. Their primary advertisers, at least in television, are pharmaceutical ads. But when that becomes, we're one of two countries in the world that allows that, New Zealand being the other one. So when, if that becomes unlawful, there's going to be a lot more coverage of the harms, and that'll support people who bring civil and criminal charges. So those are just some examples. But, you know, Europe, I don't think Europe's going to be silenced forever. I think people are going to read the Dutch and the German versions eventually of the Pfizer papers. They're available. You can order them in the UK from Amazon.uk. And then you're going to see litigation. You're going to see people being brought to justice.
And other booksellers. There's so much you've written about over the decades. I would love to have asked you about the Gaza genocide. But immigration, in the short time we have left, you've written about how elites use immigration and so on. But about the use of immigrant labor for mercenaries in the past. How important is it from a left perspective to talk about the Trump agenda in terms of the fact that immigration is used by powerful elites and not for good reasons, not for anything good?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand your question. I apologize.
You've written about immigrants used as mercenaries for the military-industrial complex in the United States.
Right.
How does that fit in with the Trump... I mean, you can hear it all on so-called liberal media in the United States that immigration, this is just racist, the policies of the Trump administration. But actually, there are more complex mechanisms at play when it comes to immigration in the United States. Tell me why there is a good reason to look at immigration in the United States and that border wall, just as Trump says that he will be.
I see what you're asking. Well, just to be clear, I didn't state that illegal immigrants were being used as mercenaries. I was concerned that there's my own reporting on my Substack Outspoken found, and it's on the White House, you know, website, that there's a three-country staging area where the State Department, U.S. State Department, in alliance with the United Nations, is bringing in these millions of people
legal
unlawfully
immigrants
to the United States. Sorry?
Legal. Legal.
No, illegal. Illegal. They are illegally in the United States. In other words, the State Department and the UN and these three countries where they're being processed are colluding to bring them into the United States illegally, which to my knowledge has never happened before, that the State Department has engaged, you know, with the UN in breaking sovereign nations' laws in that comprehensive way. But you must know that, you know, 19 to 30 million people are in the United States illegally. They are not legal immigrants. They have walked right in and not gone through the process, which is a lengthy one that my grandparents went through, for instance, and my dad, to become legal immigrants, citizens of the United States. They are illegally here. So my concern was a lot of these people who've been brought in illegally are from countries that produce mercenaries around the world. And I was also concerned that a lot of them are military age. And, you know, it's just dangerous to have a lot of people who, you know, as we see, as I predicted, the, you know, it turns out that it's cartels who are taking over and terrifying the residents of housing complexes in Colorado and now in three other states. But it's dangerous to have military age men who are here illegally, who can, you know, communicate to do bad things like take over, you know, housing complexes. That is a national security risk. And anyone would say so. You know, if 30 million people walked into Dubai, you know, the authorities would be alarmed, to say the least. They wouldn't let it happen. You can't just, you know, walk into most sovereign nations, except in Western Europe and North America now.
Professor Naomi Wolf, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those surviving the UK-US-EU armed holocaust here in this region. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.